Listen, you really put Clifford Irving away yesterday.
Oh, today, I see he gets very angry with me today.
Oh, yeah? Well, you know, obviously I didn't hear today yet, but I've heard people interview him in which they tried to ignore the fact that, you know, he bummed out on all of us with that stuff, and you didn't. I liked it.
Well, I liked it.
I
had to ask him about it.
You went straight into it, which is...
Well, I had to ask him what happened. I didn't go into a lot of detail except in my preface,
but what
has happened to him since 1978? Yeah. He's written a couple of books.
Mm-hmm.
He's done some traveling.
Yeah.
And I wanted to sort of catch up on what he's done. And today's is a little more controversial because he says he's sick and tired of being asked all those questions about Howard Hughes. We're getting a little closer.
Yeah, okay. All right. I will I'll attempt to talk. I don't think I sound too great right now, but okay. This is me talking about as well as I'm going to talk. I hope it's coming over okay. Is there anything specifically you'd like me to say? Like asking questions like, is there anything specifically you'd like me to say?
No, I just want to see it.
That water actually helped my voice.
Well, I certainly liked the book. I read it over the holidays and while I was on vacation. And then I called Alan Bader and I said, I'd like to talk to you because I enjoyed reading it. I thought it was extremely well done.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to ask some questions about that. And I think I'd like to find out a little more about yourself. Now, I have some biographical data here. I see you have quite a background and a list of credits here that you almost can't count. But I'd like to hear it, a little bit about yourself from your voice. Where are you from?
I was born in San Antonio, Texas.
Well, you missed the big snow.
I just barely missed it. You know, I was down there a couple of weeks ago. And it was... this may consist mostly of coughs. You may take out all the rest of it.
Well, when you're dealing with a matter of minutes and seconds,
right,
with a broadcast like mine...
I listen to you all the time because I stay tuned to the CBS. Because listening to the news relaxes me like nothing else. That's strange. But when I take a nap in the afternoon, I turn on the news... Turn on CBS, which is constant news, obviously. So I hear you all the time. I heard, you know, Susan Cheever and going way back.
Well, you're a devil for punishment. Huh?
No, I like it. It sort of becomes pablum eventually in your head, you know. But it takes your mind off what you were thinking before you started listening.
Strange. When I go home, I don't listen.
No, well, I'm
here all day.
That I can imagine. Anyway, I was born in San Antonio. My father was a construction engineer. He married my mother, who was an actress with a sort of a touring show. They did awful things like non-musical versions of the Carmen, and which I'm glad I didn't see, and things like that. And then he went broke in San Antonio, moved to Houston, went broke in Houston, moved down to Palacios, Texas, and went broke down in Palacios. And that's where I grew up, with my father being broke. And so I learned to work very young. Then he went away from home when I was 12. I learned to work very young and used to get a buck a day from what they call can see to can't.
What is that?
Can see to can't. That's when you can see, you start work, and when you can't see anymore, you stop. That was a dollar a day during the Depression, chopping cotton or whatever, you know. And a lot of people say, chopping cotton? What's chopping cotton? Well, they think you only pick cotton. But cotton is sown in rows, and the machinery that sows the cotton seed doesn't know how far apart to drop the seed. So you have to wait till they sprout, and then you take the healthy plants and you chop out in between them, see? And there are all kinds of exciting things like that, you know, like digging graves and so forth. But everything you did in those days, you got a dollar a day for, which made it easy, nice round figure, you know. But a dollar was worth a dollar. Now it's worth 3.5 cents, I think.
Did you, as a young man, have a literary bent?
Yes, I did. I started writing very young. I sold a short story to the one publication that I read constantly, which was Wild West Weekly. when I was 17.
And living in Texas.
And living in Texas, living in Palacios, Texas. Palacios, Texas is a town of about 2,500 people. It's a shrimping and oystering village on the coast between Houston and Corpus Christi. And
17, huh?
Yeah.
That must have been quite a thrilling experience seeing your first work in print at that age.
I didn't see it in print. They never printed it.
They didn't?
No, they didn't print it. But they.
But you got the check.
They sent me a check for $25, which was all the money I made out of writing for quite a few years. I thought I was a big author, and but I wasn't. And that taught me a lesson also.
I had a feeling that you'd rather see it in print than to have the $25.
I would have paid them. I would have been glad to give them the $25 back if they had printed it. But nothing. If they ever printed it, I never saw it. But I found out later that Wild West Weekly was owned by some company, I've forgotten whom, that had several Western magazines. And maybe they printed it in one that I didn't know about. But I kept watching Wild West Weekly for years, and I never saw it.
Which Why didn't you write the editor?
I did. And they didn't answer me. I guess their attitude was, look, kid, you got your check, forget it.
When did you leave Texas?
I left Texas to go in the Navy. I graduated from Rice in 41.
What did you study?
I studied modern language. I was the they made a special course for me. I wanted to study languages. I don't quite know why, but it was an instinct. I was just crazy about languages. So after I got finished with the things I had to take, there's a word for that, but I can't think of it. After I got finished with the things you had to take, I started taking French, Spanish, German, Italian, and English Lit.
I didn't know Rice taught all those things.
Oh, yeah. It's a very... That's funny because it's known as an engineering school, but it's actually they have a really terrific academic, terrific literary and language tradition there.
I think Donald Barthelme teaches there now.
Does he teach
or
there?
Or is it the University of Houston?
Well, I'm not sure. The University of Houston... I'm very intimately connected with because I was the water boy on the construction gang that built the administration building at the University of Houston, the first building that was ever built there. My job was water boy. And I've always felt a warm place in my heart for that university since then.
Yeah.
But they've never invited me back or given me any kind of a honorary degree because of that. Maybe they don't know I was there.
Well, you've got a... trumpet your own horn. You let them know that you carry the water in the days when it was really important.
That's right. You had two buckets. You had a black bucket and a white bucket in those days.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I remember I grew up in Houston, and at the Herman Park Zoo, they had the black drinking fountain and the white drinking fountain side by side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's incredible to think about it now, but Houston seems so urban and grown up and sophisticated.
Yeah.
But it's hard to remember.
Yeah. How did you grow up in Houston and not have the same kind of accent that I've got?
Well, I went back to the Midwest where I had been born and went to college there.
Yeah.
Although my family still, my mother and father still live in Houston. My brother, a whole bunch of relatives, they still live down there. Most of them have the accent.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I've got relatives living there, too. I was down there just recently, as a matter of fact.
What did you do when you got out of the Navy?
I went to Yale Drama School. And put in 1 year at Yale Drama School, my wife and I got divorced, and I went to work in Houston selling floor furnaces and real estate, things like that, and trying to be a writer and starving.
When you went to Yale, did you want to become an actor or a...
No, I wanted to be a playwright.
You wanted to be a playwright.
But I did a lot of acting at Yale because they didn't have very many guys there. You know, they had very few, men to work with in the acting, all the plays they were putting on. So they were casting me all the time. So, because they always had room for a big, tall, slouchy, stoop-shouldered fella. And I enjoyed it a lot, but I'm glad I didn't go into acting.
Thomas McGuane, a Western writer, also went to Yale for the purpose of studying playwriting. Do they actually have a training in playwriting as such?
Yeah. They have, at the time I went there, somebody's going to throw us a fish if we don't stop.
That's right.
At the time I went there, Walter Pritchard Eaton was the playwriting teacher. He was very famous. He came right after another famous teacher named George Pierce Baker. Eaton didn't lecture. You read your material in class, and then the class criticized, and he guided the criticism. And it was cruel. A lot of people who came there wanting to be playwrights left wanting to be bankers. Because if you didn't have any talent, you were exposed right away because there was no coddling. Nobody said, oh, that's wonderful. People say, oh, God, don't inflict another, you know, act of that thing on us again, that sort of thing, which is marvelous training. If you could come out of there and still want to be a playwright, you're either talented or you're thick-skinned.
So that's why there's so many bankers from Yale and New York City.
right. Yeah.
Incredible. They all have, most people from Yale live down Wall Street. They
true,
really
yeah.
do. Well, you went after, you graduated from...
No, I just went 1 year at Yale Drama School.
You went back to Houston, you began to...
I figure if Eugene O'Neill only went 1 year, you know, why should I go more?
Absolutely. So you began selling what in Houston?
Coleman floor furnaces and real estate. And I didn't do that too well. I wasn't very good at either one of them. And then I came back to New York.
How can you do a bad job selling real estate in Houston?
It's difficult. You have to be almost totally devoid of talent, which apparently I was. Then after a year of that, I came back to New York and went to work for the York Corporation. The only thing I knew how to do was sell things, and I couldn't do that either.
They made air conditioners, right?
That's right. Air conditioners and refrigeration, that sort of thing.
Based in New York, Pennsylvania.
That's right. They sent me to their school down there, and they made what they call an application engineer out of me. And that's a euphemism for salesman.
That's another town I worked in.
Oh, really?
many 25 years ago as a fledgling news reporter.
Oh, yeah, how do you know?
Little station there.
I knew a fellow down there that you probably know. I can't think of his name now. You will have forgotten him. That's the guy. Yes. He went to Yale Drama School, as a matter of fact, and went in the advertising business in New York, Pennsylvania. Howard somebody or other. At any rate, doesn't matter. Finally, I sold something to Philco Playhouse, Fred Cole, which was kind of a miracle because I didn't have an agent, and nobody would read anything that I wrote. And I wrote this thing for Philco, designed for Philco Playhouse. And I took it up to NBC and took it up to Fred Coe's office, handed it to his assistant, who was a chap I happened to know, named Robert Costello, who later became a producer. And Bob Costello thought that I had arranged for Terry Lewis to read it. He didn't, so he took it in and put it on her desk. And a couple of days later, she called me up and said, "Who's your agent?" I said, "I don't have one." She said, "Well, how'd I get this script?" I said, "I brought it up there." And she said, "If I'd known that, I wouldn't have read it. We don't accept unsolicited manuscripts." But now that I've read it, I want to buy it.
What was that?
It was called Hide and Seek.
Is that in your... must be in your...
It's in there somewhere, I think. Hide and Seek was my very first show.
1954.
Yeah, and it had Mildred Dunnock and Betty Field in it, and you can't ask for better than that. And it was directed by Arthur Penn. That's a pretty good way to start.
Oh, I'll say, yeah. You were really in the forefront of those early... They were all live, weren't they?
Yeah.
You were in the forefront of those. Look at all of the... You had... In 1954, you had... 5 television plays.
Yeah. When you really want to be a writer and you finally get a chance to have a platform, you don't want to sleep, you don't want to take weekends off. As long as somebody wants to buy it, you better keep working. So I started writing. I didn't stop, until I kind of ran out of gas after about a year. I decided I better take 2 weeks off. But I had all these stories backed up in my head that wanted to come out, you know.
And the following year, you turned out a screenplay.
The Rabbit Trap. That was based on one of my television plays on Philco. Yeah.
What was that about? That has a very familiar ring.
The Rabbit Trap was a story that had been turned down by several producers, including Philco. But when I told it to Fred Coe in person, he bought it. It was a story of a man who was being bullied by his boss. He worked for a construction firm in Long Island City, and he was being bullied by his boss. And he finally decides that he's going to take 2 weeks off and take his family to Vermont for a vacation. And he takes his little boy, goes to Vermont with his wife and his little boy, and they have a cabin up there, and they set a trap to catch a rabbit. And he tells the little boy, we're going to just catch this rabbit, and then we're going to make friends with him, and we're not going to harm him, and then we're going to let him go. But we just want to do this to have fun and to show the rabbit that we love him, and so on. And the kid was very impressed. And they set this rabbit trap. And the boss sends word that he's got an emergency at the office, and the guy's got to go back. So he chickens out, and he goes back to Long Island City. And in the middle of the night, his little kid says, Dad, what about the rabbit? He says, what about it? He says, well, the rabbit's going to get caught in that trap, and he's going to die because of us. Now the father's ripped apart. So he goes in, he tells his boss, I got to go back to Vermont and unset this rabbit trap. Well, you can imagine the head of a construction firm that's in the middle of an emergency saying, oh, sure, go ahead, it's all right. He said, not forget it. He says, I'll buy the kid a rabbit. You know, I'll buy him 10 rabbits, but tell him to forget it. Well, the guy finally realizes that the rabbit in the trap is him.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes his family and he goes back to Vermont. Now, the funny thing about this story is, first of all, it was a big smash. It was a terrific hit. The funny thing about it is that now it's one of the most popular shows behind the Iron Curtain. Everywhere that there is rampant leftism, this is thought of. This is the little guy against his boss. See, now I'm an orthodox capitalist, you know, but I still take the rubles or whatever they are when which they never send. But once in a while, I get, you know, 13 cents from some some place where they've been doing the rabbit trap. But
wonderful story.
It's wonderful. It's kind of fun.
I should also ask you just briefly, what was hide and seek? What was the theme of hide and seek?
Hide and seek was two sisters, one of whom was blind, and one of whom had eloped. When she was very young, with an apparently wealthy chap, and gone away and hadn't gotten in touch with her blind sister. Well, her sister had gone blind after that. And here was this poor blind lady living in the South with practically nothing, and her sister writes to her and says she wants to come and see her. And it's a pride game, because the sister that went away is now poor and looking for a home, but doesn't want to admit it, and the blind lady doesn't know it. She thinks she's coming down to lord it over her. And she discovers the truth about her sister when she touches her suitcase and feels the rope around it. And that was a nice scene.
Yeah.
Arthur Penn did a wonderful job on that.
For sure. Your smash is one that we still see on television, The Days of Wine and Roses. That did a lot for you, didn't it?
It didn't hurt. It didn't hurt. No, everybody should have Days of Wine and Roses. Every writer, you know, should have one of those, because it's something that people identify you by. You know, they might not know my name, but they know that name, which is nice.
That was about alcoholism, as I recall.
Yes.
Who was in the television?
Cliff Robertson and Piper Laurie did the Playhouse 90. And Then, of course, Jack Lemmon and Lee Remick did the movie.
And you didn't have any personal experience with alcoholism?
I had a lot of personal experience, but not... I myself was never an alcoholic, but I did my best. You know, I did my share of drinking. It just didn't take. I had an uncle who was an alcoholic who lived with us during the Depression. And the thing that got me interested in alcoholism actually was the fact that he came home on Christmas Eve. And this was, I mean, this was poor time. When you're talking poor, you're talking us. I mean, we didn't have anything. We cut out colored paper, pasted it together with flour paste, and hung these little loops around on the Christmas tree. We had candles. We cut these candles into four different pieces, so we'd have four candles instead of one. We tied those into the Christmas tree, that sort of thing. We had this Christmas tree decorated, and my uncle Fred came home, and something about his Christmas tree enraged him, and he tore it up. Almost burned the house down, too. So here, my sisters and me, my mother, her sister, his wife, and her three daughters, all cowering in various dark corners of the house, hoping he's not going to break our bones, and he's tearing the Christmas tree limb from limb. And that's something that one doesn't forget, you know, especially when one grows up to be a writer. So it became a scene, actually, in Days of Wine and Roses when the guy goes and tears up the greenhouse. I mean, I realized that after I wrote it. I didn't know that that was what inspired it, obviously. You know, I think if you're conscious of that, it doesn't happen, obviously, but it's your subconscious pulling this stuff out.
This huge list of credits for screenplays and teleplays is not obscured by your novels, because you have written your third novel. Your first was 1968, I see here. Tell me how your first novel came about, The Race for Home.
Well, I had been wanting to write a novel for a long time. I literally couldn't afford it. I mean, you know, it's a big commitment of time. And I was writing for a living. And I've always, since I started writing, I've written for a living. I've never had another job, you know, which is probably a mistake. But somehow or other, I felt that I just wanted to do the thing that I wanted to do, which was writing, and if I made a good living or a bad living. So I finally got enough money ahead to start a novel, and the first novels are almost always, as you know, you've interviewed a lot of writers, first novels are autobiographical. They're all about the guy or the gal when they were, young. And this one was about my experiences as a kid, more or less homeless, in the Depression, disguised, hopefully, but apparently not very well. And it all took place in a town called Espada, which was a very thinly disguised Palacios, Texas, as I found out from all the people who lived down there who wanted to tar and feather me after they read the book. But it was a great experience. Writing a book was a great experience. There's nothing so wonderful to me, and I'm sure it's what keeps other writers writing, is when you're writing, you're a conduit for all of these people that are in you wanting to get out, and all of these things that are in there that are not necessarily people, but, you know, demons or whatever. You're a conduit for those, and you feel wonderful because they're getting out of you. They're not fighting inside you. So the act of writing, to me, is that kind of thing. It's when you're not writing that all of these people and all of these demons, you're not quite sure which of them really represents you or what mix of them represents you, but they're all in there fighting or arguing or kicking and turning somersaults or whatever. And that's when you get into trouble. That's when you want to go get drunk or something, because you're upset. You're miserable. And you don't know why. But when you start to write, at least I'll say you, when I start to write, and I've talked to other writers who feel the same way, everything is wonderful. Because you're not necessarily in control, but you feel this marvelous sense of release because all of this is happening through you instead of within you.
You've written three novels and so many screenplays and teleplays here, I really can't count them. With the screenplays and the television plays, you don't have to worry about a narrative as such. With the novels, obviously, you have to fill in between the dialogue. Did you have any adjustment, or have you had any adjustment making this transition to print?
Yes. Yeah, I did. It was very difficult at first because it was a whole different concept. And I found that I was very self-conscious. I didn't really know what worked and what didn't work. I only found out by... It was like starting over again, almost. I had confidence as a dramatic writer, writing a play or a screenplay. But when I began to write description and narrative, I really had no confidence at all. I wrote and rewrote and re-rewrote until they almost had to pull the stuff out of my hands to get it to the publisher, because I just didn't know whether it was good or not. And I feel better about it now. I mean, I feel more confident about it now. But at the time that I started, it was like starting over again.
I was reading the new biography of William Saroyan recently, and there's a story in the biography about his writing The Human Comedy, which was originally a screenplay. Mm-hmm. And he thought that he'd make a short story out of it. And man, he was taken off. He had written the first version of The Human Comedy, and he was taken off of it, and somebody else rewrote it, changed it somewhat by the time it reached the screen with Mickey Rooney. But he had a lot of the dialogue, so he made a short story and sent it on to his agent, who said, "This is too good to be a short story. Why don't you fill in between the, mm-hmm. the dialogue?" Uh-huh. And make this into a novel. And it became his first novel.
Yeah.
And it was an acclaimed book, and still is probably his most famous work.
Yeah, and it's terrific. Yeah. And he was terrific. And I really was sorry for the way he ended. I think he was almost as persecuted by the tax people as Joe Louis was. There were two wonderful people who got in trouble with IRS, and the only way they could get out of trouble was to die. Which is kind of a shame, isn't it?
It's not the way to do it.
No.
you live on near the Delaware River, is that correct?
Yes.
And where do you live?
I live between Stockton and Frenchtown. I live out in the country, mm-hmm. up on top of a hill. You can't see anything but trees and deer and pheasant and an occasional fox from my living room. And it's a marvelous place to live. I recommend it.
You certainly took advantage of where you live for your locales in the school, didn't you?
Yeah, I
is there such a cave along the Delaware River that you know of?
There is no such cave, I swear it. A lot of people have asked me that. As a matter of fact, people come up and say, "Come on, tell me. I know there really is a cave there someplace, and you're keeping it to yourself." But there is no such cave there. If there is, then I haven't found it. But I had a lot of trouble, a lot of fun inventing it. It's strange. Once my hero got into this cave, he couldn't see it because he didn't have any lights or anything. But once he got a light, and when he saw the cave, I saw the cave. It just sort of sprang into being in its total grandeur to me at the same time he saw it. So it was really fun because I didn't know what it was going to look like either.
Were you writing spontaneously when you began the scoop?
I always write spontaneously, but it's triggered by a lot of previous thought. I mean, I knew vaguely. I mean, the cave being a metaphor for man's life, in a sense, that we're all in a cave, some in bigger and darker caves than others, and some with more monsters in them than others, and so on. But I do write spontaneously, and then obviously when I get some objectivity, I go and edit it back and try to make some sense of it. Doesn't always make sense when I first write it.
He was an unlikely hero, too. He went down. It was Mexico, I believe.
Yeah.
Mexico. Have you been down to Mexico?
Oh, yeah. I made several trips to Mexico to research. I went and found exactly where I wanted them to come ashore and exactly where I wanted them to live. And I even hired a guide and went out. At one time, I was going to have more of a section about his archaeological explorations. I hired a guide and went out to some of the Olmec ruins and some of the vine-grown ruins in the jungle that haven't even been touched yet by the National Geographic people. It's a fascinating area, and I almost got so stuck on it I wanted to stay there.
Well, I'm glad you didn't put too much of the the material about the digs and so forth in there, because I think that's another book.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I cut a lot of it out. I got fascinated with it. I wrote a lot of it in, and then I just chopped it mercilessly back because I realized the book was really over.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's over, you got to get off, you know. But it was fun doing it.
You've made a nice mystery out of a book that I didn't think was going to be a mystery, but you tied up the ends very well. At first, as I began to read it, of course, I wasn't sure when the great bear appeared down and taking swipes with a huge paw and everything. I wasn't sure whether I was reading a fantasy like Stephen King and Peter Straub or what I was reading, but everything worked out pretty well at the end, and I think I know what I've read now. But I think you'll fool the readers. I think you have fooled the readers as they read it.
Well, I set out actually to make everything real. I set out to make it not a fantasy. I didn't want you to say this is a fantasy. I wanted to lead you into it so that you would actually believe it while you were there. And I worked very hard at trying to make that such detail that it just didn't seem like a fantastic creature or something that you were hallucinating, you know. It was a game to me to try to make you suspend your disbelief while you were there with him. And apparently it works with most people.
There's something else unusual about your novel, and it appears on the front dust jacket. Can you tell us what that is?
Well, it's a hologram, and it's the first one that's ever been used on the cover of a novel, and I was really pleased with it. I think it's probably going to be used a lot now because it's fascinating to look at a three-dimensional creature coming at you out of a flat surface. But I drew a sketch of the skook, and then Warner Books had a sculptor make a small figure in three dimensions, and then it was shot with laser photography to make it look like a three-dimensional object in spite of the fact that it's on a flat surface. It still looks like magic to me. I mean, I'm as impressed as the people in Borneo were with the first airplane. I mean,
in fact, there's a museum of holography here in New York.
Yes.
Have you been there?
I have not been there.
You ought to try to get them to display a copy. Museum. It's a first.
I'll even give them one.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and I certainly enjoy talking to you about it and catching up on what you've been doing. Oh, I did want to ask you one other thing. You are living out in the country. That's not a hindrance to you as a writer, is it, being so isolated from the city?
It's not only not a hindrance, it's the best thing I ever did, because I don't have any drop-in friends. I don't end up going to cocktail parties. I just stay home and behave myself most of the time. Not all of the time, but most of the time. I walk 17 steps from my bedroom into my office where I work, and that saves me a lot of commuting time. It's the smartest thing I ever did. I love it. I don't want to ever change that setup. But if I want to come to New York, or I want to go to Princeton to a cocktail party, or if I want to go play tennis, it's right down the road. It's terrific. But yeah, that sense of isolation, it's It's, you know, the old ivory tower concept without the ivory tower.
Well, in the authoring business, as Gordon Lish says in one of his novels, the authoring business, don't you have to go out for lunches a lot? Because all the publishers and editors I know have their days blocked because of their lunches.
Yeah.
11:30 to 3:30 in the afternoon, you can't get an editor or a publisher because he's making a deal with the writer someplace over lunch.
Well, at the rate of one book every 2 or 3 years, I don't have to have that many lunches with editors. I'm not very much in the swim. I'm totally out of the swim, as a matter of fact. I know they do that, but it must be fun, too. But it's an awful long way to go for lunch.
Well, since Hide and Seek, I imagine you have an agent now.
Yeah, yes, I do. I do have a very good agent. I have a couple of good agents, yes.
J.P. Miller, thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. You're certainly an interesting guy and interesting past, and it was a lot of fun talking to you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.